It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Summer vacation is starting for young people around the Pittsburgh area. It's a time when many kids would like to go to work and earn some money, in addition to learning skills they may one day put to good use in the workforce. In recent years, the supply of jobs has fallen short of matching the demand for them. But the summer job market for teens and young adults in the Pittsburgh area is growing thanks to a multi-million dollar initiative called Learn and Earn, involving a collaboration between the city, Allegheny County, and the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. Here to talk about it and how it works, as well as who benefits, is Barb Parise, Deputy County Manager for Allegheny County. Barb, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Also joining us in studio is Stephanie Pashman. She is Chief Executive Officer of the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. Stephanie, good to have you with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. How is your summer job search going? What kind of help do you need finding a summer job? What questions do you have about this program and how it works? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And Stephanie, let's start with you. How did this collaboration come about and what's being done to provide summer employment?
So this is a collaboration that was galvanized by the leadership of the mayor and the county executive, who for the first time said, we need to do a lot more than the individual fragmented small programs we have in our region for youth. And historically, there's maybe been enough programming for about 400, 500 youth in the area by multiple organizations. And through the mayor and county executive, they brought us all together and said, we're going to do something more for youth. And we're going to serve every youth that can be served this summer.
And was there some kind of an alarm bell that went off, something that said, you know, we have to do something?
It wasn't an alarm bell. I think it was just the moment was ripe with the right folks in place to say we know how to collaborate and
Meaning
we're ready
the,
to
the,
do it.
A mayor and a county executive who get along?
Absolutely. And a workforce system through the workforce board that is prepared and poised to implement this initiative. And we have a foundation community that was right at the table with us saying we're willing to help, and a corporate community that's opening their doors for the youth and also providing financial support as well. So all of those players came together to make this happen.
And Barb Parise, when Stephanie Pashman says, the time was ripe to do this, in Allegheny County, the summer youth job market shrunk by 55% over a little more than a decade between 2000 and 2013. How does this program address that jobs shortfall as well as the problem of disconnected youth, meaning young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who were neither in school or employed?
I think that some of what happens is that this is a program that includes not only employment opportunities, but some work readiness training. You're taking young people who may not be comfortable entering the workforce and providing them with some skill-based learning about what it's like to be in a workplace and helping to place them oftentimes in their own community, because this program is throughout the county and the city. And young people, especially on the younger end, are more likely to go to work in their own community. So we're beginning to build a workforce. I think that one of the things I heard long ago is that capital follows a skilled workforce. And I think there's no better place to start than with young people to begin to build a workforce that will help this whole region grow.
We have Olivia on Twitter who asks, what sort of summer jobs are out there in this day and age? I remember being a part-time cashier / babysitter, says Olivia.
So one of the things that's really unique about this program, Olivia, is that we know that of these jobs that there were very few, most youth were doing things like working in food services or working in retail. And what we've done this year is expand the diversity of options available. So we're going to have youth this summer who are making video games for training in company settings. We have youth that are going working in the libraries. We have youth that are going to be working in banks, in healthcare facilities. We have youth working in urban gardening. So the diversity of opportunities are available to meet the diversity of interests of the youth.
And how do you know who's out there, what they're looking for, and how they are going about finding jobs? A lot of us were younger, and, you know, Olivia just tweeted about her experience, and we'd love to have people share their experiences with us. But, you know, those of us of a certain age remember just, you know, your mom drops you off in, say, you know, if you lived in the East End, maybe she drops you off in Shadyside, where there's a, where, you know, there were a lot of, and still are, a lot of retail shops and, you know, restaurants and coffee shops and things like that. And, you know, you went from shop to shop and you just asked, do you have anything available? And it was really hit and miss. There's, I'm sure it's much more scientific today. So how have you researched, you know, what skill sets you can match with the jobs that are available? Barb.
Right. The way Learn and Earn works addresses, I think, that issue pretty well, because we work with a huge variety of community-based organizations who are the ones that are finding these employment opportunities in their communities. Organizations like the Homewood Children's Village, Youth Places, Goodwill, the Braddock Youth Project, Bloomfield Garfield Association. Those people are people in the community who want to work with youth, who want to give them these kinds of opportunities, and who look at the youth in terms of what their skill sets are, what their career aspirations are. Those are all things that we ask in the during the application process. And then there's actually a matching process where we try to place a young person in a position like the ones that Stephanie mentioned, and with a supporting organization behind them that's going to help them be successful.
So what was happening before this effort started? Was it just, you know, kids were haphazardly, you know, doing the hit and miss, I'd love to work for you thing, not even knowing if they had the skills to match a job or an opening that an employer might have, and then a lot of them ending up with nothing for 3 months, you know, and spending their summer not being as productive as they could be?
That's absolutely correct. I think one of the things about this program, first of all, we're focused on disadvantaged youth, so low-income youth who very often don't have opportunities like the ones that we're able to provide this summer. And most of them were working in food service, in whatever job they could find, probably not the number of hours they would want, and not providing the skill-based training opportunities that we are affording this summer. And so I would say that the structure and the quality of the experiences and our ability to support them with the types of organizations Barb is talking about is very unique and something that will hopefully help our corporate community then find the pipeline of workers they need to fill their jobs in the future.
Also, when you fail your first time out, you know, you're less likely to want to go back and try again. And so we're very focused on helping these young people be successful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if my first, you know, position, I felt completely unprepared for. And in fact, the result was that I was not successful at the work and perhaps lost the job or walked away from it because I didn't feel good there. I'm not likely to want to do it again. So we're hoping to change that dynamic for a lot of young people.
And does a lot of it have to do with expectation and understanding what an employer expects of you? For example, a recent story that I overheard was about a young man who had just graduated high school and got a job working at a particular fast food place, one of the big ones. We won't mention the name, but got the job. And one of the first things they required him to do was to watch a training video. And apparently he was expected to show up in uniform to watch the video, but he didn't realize he was going to be doing any particular, you know, work online that day. So that he showed up in regular civilian clothes and got a chewing out, and you know, didn't take it well and walked out and never came back. So is part of this effort trying to avoid those breakdowns in communication?
That's very much the story that we're trying to eliminate. And that's why we have built in addition to the actual sites where youth are working, we have a whole infrastructure of community-based organizations throughout all the neighborhoods that are poised, prepared to support the youth throughout the experience. So if they can't show up that day, if they're having a challenge, then they call us and we can help provide whatever problem solving is needed. And in addition, we have a group of attorneys through the Allegheny Bar Association who did a clothing drive with Dress to Success, so we can dress all the youth in appropriate attire for whatever place they have to work, whether it's khakis for a more casual place or dresses and suits for a corporate environment. And so we are trying to make sure that we understand in every single employer setting what is needed, make sure the youth are aware of how different those things can be, and then be able to have support for them when they have a challenge, when they hit a wall, when they don't know how to problem solve.
And so a lot of what is happening here is this is about the employers being altruistic and community-minded and doing a service, really, for these young people. I mean, they're going to get something out of this, but it's the young people who are really getting something out of this and society benefiting in the long run by the skills from the skills that these youth acquire.
And what happens in this program is that you have realistic expectations on both sides. The young person comes, hopefully, after our week of work readiness training with some realistic expectation, and the employer has chosen to be part of this program. So they have realistic expectations, whereas the example you gave of a young person walking into a large, you know, restaurant or whatever it was and not being successful, there was nobody there probably that had a very realistic expectation of what could happen. And, you know, we're talking about youth, but I've been in workforce development a lot of years. And adults have the same issues. If you're new to the workplace at any age, these are things that you need to know. And so we're trying to get these young people started right.
And one question that comes to mind is how much can you really, you know, how much can a young person who probably doesn't have a great deal of experience, might be smart and have a great attitude and aptitude and all of that, but in 3 months, realistically, you know, what it's not like the employer is going to come out with this chart and say, okay, here's where we want to be by the time you leave at the end of August.
Well, actually, one of the pieces that we've added to the program this year is a formal evaluation through a team at Pitt so we can understand what do they look like when they came in, what do they look like to come out, and where is it going to be?
The employee, but it's more about the employee than the employer meeting some particular production goal.
Well, I was going to mention that with each of these experiences, we have defined levels within the program where we know what we can expect coming in and coming out. So, for example, there's a series of youth who've never worked before. They're called our level one, tier one individuals. And they might be working in a camp or helping to rehab a lot. And then there's youth at a middle level and youth at a higher level. And with each of those levels, we have a very defined expectation of what the host site can expect and what the youth should get out of that experience. And in some cases, yes, they're contributing an actual project-based work or providing service learning or contributing something concrete to that company. But as Barb said, one of the keys is this, is that the expectations are managed on both sides. It's defined. And then we're going to evaluate it, measure it, and see what happened.
We are talking about the multi-million dollar initiative called Learn and Earn, involving a collaboration between the city, Allegheny County, and the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. And talking about it with Barb Parise, who is Deputy County Manager for Allegheny County, as well as Stephanie Pashman, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. If you have a comment or question, want to know more about how this program works, perhaps how you can get involved, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. And there's this three-tiered approach here. Barb, describe what all this incorporates.
Well, in some ways, it's age-based. As Stephanie said, the young person, 14 to 15-year-old, just coming into the workplace, it's getting them to a place where they will have reasonable expectations to do work that they can be successful at doing. And then in Tier 2, it's putting those people, 16, 17-year-olds perhaps, it's not completely age-based, but that's a good measure, putting them into a workplace. And part of the goal and part of what happens over this experience is that young people know where they fit in their family, they know where they fit in a school, but they come to know through this experience, I could fit in this workplace. You know, they get to know the culture of the workplace. They get to go know a guy like you in this workplace and to see how people behave toward one another and toward the work. And so that's really important. And then the third tier are really young people who are going to be going to a bank, to a more professional type of experience, a more complicated workplace. And they come with some skills, and they've been, hopefully, many of them have been through this program in a tiered kind of way and are ready to go into a workplace where there's more expected of them and where they can have a more stronger experience, I would say.
One of the keys in this whole program is that we know that youth only learn to work by working. And we hear from our companies repeatedly that one of the things they can't hire for and where they have trouble finding folks to hire is that they don't have what we call the soft skills. They don't necessarily know how to show up on time, how to behave in an environment, and how to have that more the less tangible side of in a workplace. And this summer, fusing those skills into the youth and really teaching them how to work. And I think we can't underestimate the value of making sure that we have folks who know how to operate and perform in a workplace setting.
And how do you ultimately measure the value of that? Down the road, how does this impact the just the overall productivity of the American workforce, or in this case, to localize it more, of the workforce in Allegheny County and the city of Pittsburgh.
Right. So it's our job at the Workforce Board to kind of make sure that we have a locally prepared workforce. And so we do work throughout the year with companies and with youth and trying to make sure that we get folks on a path of success and that we help companies be prepared. And so we're always doing a lot of data and evaluation on where we see the jobs, where the jobs are going, and where the programs are that make sense. And so I think we are very equipped to be able to look at this and say, what happened down the line? And did this youth get launched on that path? And we're going to track them to be able to see, did they go to college? Did they get a job? And we're going to go back to the companies and say, what happened? And we're going to be able to see if our disconnect between the open jobs and the unemployed people actually closes. And so that's one of the things that is our task on this, is to kind of continue to evaluate, to look, and to understand the impact of these programs. In addition, we've seen a lot of research come out about the impact of these programs on crime rates, on truancy, on some of those other types of things. And we saw some research come out of Chicago. And so this summer, we're also going to measure some of those pieces as well to see if we have a little bit of reduction in crime and some of the things that come with youth not having things to do in the summer.
And I would have to think that this is life-changing for a lot of young people if they have this opportunity that they, you know, if you're going to expect that kids are going to, you know, find positive ways to entertain themselves over the course of, you know, the 60 to 90 day summer vacation, and some will, but a lot more, you know, given the opportunity, given a lot of idle time, will find unproductive ways to entertain and amuse themselves. So I'm guessing, Barb, that this is a life-changing program in many ways.
It is. And, you know, anecdotally, we hear stories throughout the summer, and we have an end of the summer celebration where a number of young people speak about their experience. And I remember a number of years ago that a young woman from the North Side had gone to work at a corporation for the summer, and she gave a wonderful speech about all of the things that she had learned there. And at the end of it, and she said, "And I learned one thing for certain, I have got to learn to play golf." And that always stuck with me as just the best of an experience. Exactly. I think that's what she was learning.
Well, and the other thing that it sounds like this program has or actually doesn't have are a lot of restrictions. Are there restrictions as far as, you know, income, you know, age, experience, you know, how far along in school you are, that kind of thing? Or is it really open?
The main restriction is that it's for low-income individuals. Right. We're looking for disadvantaged youth, and we did screen for low-income individuals when we were doing the initial screening on this.
And the age.
And we did screen for age, excuse me. That's, uh-huh. That's
14
true as well.
To 21.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So anybody over 21 certainly wouldn't be eligible for this, but there are income restrictions. You know, is it harder for someone who comes from that low-income background to get the opportunities?
Absolutely.
I think so. And you said the word networking, you know, whereas if you come from an environment where there are more people around you employed and they can guide you and lead you to other opportunities, that's more likely to happen, and less likely to happen probably in an environment where not as many people are working and have those kinds of connections. So it's sort of a networking thing.
It's leveling the playing field.
Absolutely.
Really? Yes.
And the family income level is an indicator of what kind of income is infused into that family. So it shows us that many of these youths, no one is working in their household, or if they are working, they're working at a very low wage job. And so we're trying very hard to get youth exposed to the broader diversity of careers available to them.
So that someone who fits into these categories is able to maybe look forward to doing something more than working at a fast food restaurant at an age when they would probably prefer to be moving on to something else.
Absolutely. Right. We want to inspire hope in these youth and open their minds.
And raise their expectations of what is available for them in the future.
We have a few more minutes left with Barb Parise. She's Deputy County Manager for Allegheny County, and Stephanie Pashman, Chief Executive Officer of the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. Again, that's the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. And the number to call for a comment or question is 412-246-2002. I'm guessing a lot of people listening to this are wondering, how can I get involved? How do students get involved?
So for this summer, unfortunately, the application period closed a few weeks ago.
Surprised to hear that.
Yes. This week is the week that we're placing our youth. So we get started on June 30th. So we're in a pretty crunch phase of making things happen. But they should look for us for next summer. Our website is www.trwib.org, and we work on workforce programs throughout the year and have many opportunities both for adult and youth to be served in many other capacities.
Are there some success stories that you can share with us just as far as, you know, someone who started in this program and who has gone on to change their life?
So we had a woman that worked with us a few years ago, and Jasmine. And Jasmine is a youth who during the summer we know was homeless at various points. She tried to be very private about it. She showed up every day on time. She was professional. She was polite. And she wasn't sure where she was going in her life. And a couple folks on my team were particularly engaged with mentoring her. And she ended up in a two-year program. She got a culinary degree, and she started as a head chef this year. And I think it was because she had some sort of mentoring capacity outside the home, a level of stability during her summer to go somewhere every day, even though when she went home, it was a little bit unclear where she was going. And she got a plan, and she got a vision for her direction. And that story repeats itself again and again and again and again with our summer programs.
That's a great story. What are the things that you're looking to add to or ways in which you're looking to expand this program in the coming years?
Well, we always need more companies to open their doors. I think one of the challenges, we know that it's very hard to host a high school student. And so we make it easy. It's only part-time, 20 hours, 6 weeks. And so the more companies that are willing to open their doors for youth, the more youth we can expose to opportunities. And that's, I think, our biggest plea to the community is fundraising is challenging, but the bigger challenge is finding the right places to put these youth.
Who are some of the companies that are involved in this that have stepped up to the plate?
So Highmark, UPMC, PNC, Smart Big Employers, Giant Eagle, Schneider Downs, many of the large corporate players in our community. About 30 companies right now are participating this summer.
Well, it's an interesting program and one whose time has come. Certainly, again, we've been talking about a multi-million-dollar initiative called Learn and Earn, involving a collaboration between the city, Allegheny County, and the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. And talking about it with Barb Parise, she's Deputy County Manager for Allegheny County, and also Stephanie Pashman, who is Chief Executive Officer of the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board. And anybody who wants to find out more information about this, where do they go? What can they do?
Well, I would say it's on the county's website, the city's website, and certainly on the Three Rivers Workforce Investment Board website. Information about the program?
Exactly.
Anywhere else?
Yeah. Exactly.
And we can put a link to it on our website at WESA.FM. Again, Stephanie Pashman and Barb Parise, thank you so much for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Coming up, NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep joins us to talk about his new book, Jacksonland. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. On a past segment of our program, we focused on a stage piece performed in town called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. It redefined Andrew Jackson, America's seventh president. Few chief executives could inspire such an over-the-top rock musical. Now, Jackson is the subject of a new biography by Steve Inskeep called Jacksonland. Mr. Inskeep, of course, can be heard as host of Morning Edition here on 90.5 WESA. He is an award-winning broadcast journalist, so it would stand to reason that only a larger-than-life figure like Jackson could command the attention and devotion of one as talented as Mr. Inskeep, who joins us now by phone. Steve Inskeep, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. I'll need a moment to recover from that introduction. I'm honored. It's good to be here.
What made you want to tackle the story of such a complicated, conflicted individual who was a genuine American hero and yet a man who inflicted so much devastation on Native Americans in particular? It's a complicated story to tell, isn't it?
It is a complicated story. It's an incredibly complicated life because Jackson crammed so much into it. I don't know that he ever actually played rock music. There seems to be no evidence of that, but he did virtually everything else. He rose from very humble beginnings to become a war hero and a full-time general and president of the United States and founder of the Democratic Party and a man who established a more strong presidency than had existed before. It's an astonishing story, but as you say, it's also a really dark story, a grim story, which that musical attempted to bring to light, I believe, in a satirical way, because Jackson was rising to power at a time when the United States was rapidly expanding. It was expanding into Indian lands, legally constituted Indian nations, particularly in his time in the southern United States. And it was one of the great projects of his life for more than 20 years to fight to grab Indian land through wars, through treaties, and a variety of other means, including intimidation and coercion. And all along the way, he was resisted by one of his former soldiers, a Cherokee, John Ross, who'd been in his army in the War of 1812, but then rose to Cherokee leadership and used the very democratic system that Jackson was the hero of to oppose Andrew Jackson.
Describe Jackson's contrasts. Who was he at his best? Who was he at his worst?
Well, at his best, he was persistent. He didn't give up. It's astonishing to read of him in the War of 1812, racked by dysentery, with two bullets in his body, not from battles, but from duels and gunfights he'd fought in the past. He was a quite violent-tempered man. And so he's in terrible physical shape. He's a stick man in uniform, but he refused to quit. He refused to give up. His army would even abandon him. Men's enlistments would run out, and they'd simply march home and leave him with a handful of soldiers in what was then Mississippi Territory, is now the state of Alabama, and he's there facing an enemy, a rebel faction of the Creek Nation, which had risen up against its own leaders and against the United States. But he was persistent. He kept at it. He never gave up. That's where he was at his best. And he could also be fair to people, surprisingly enough, including Indians. The Indians in his army received equal pay and benefits as white soldiers. That's what he wanted them to get. So he could be fair, but that could be overtaken by his interest in his own personal finances, and especially his interest in real estate. He had been a land speculator for most of his adult life, and he was intensely interested in obtaining Indian lands. And quite often, once he obtained that land for the United States as public land, he would figure out ways to obtain key slices of it for himself. And he colonized that land, along with his friends colonized that land, with plantations worked by enslaved laborers.
Does this put Jackson in a category with Warren Harding and Richard Nixon, you know, in terms of the as you say in the book, the way he managed national security affairs in a way that matched his interest in land development?
Well, now that's a really interesting question. I guess you raise Warren Harding because there were massive scandals in his administration.
Teapot Dome.
Exactly. I wouldn't put Harding in the same category as Jackson. They're just very different figures, and Harding did not live all that long as president, and not all that much of consequence happened. I think that comparing Andrew Jackson with Richard Nixon is not 100% off base, because in each case we had very effective political figures who made significant changes in this country, who nevertheless were deeply, you could say, troubled individuals or flawed characters. We're all flawed, of course, but they were gigantic characters with gigantic flaws. You would probably, if you were ranking presidents, put Andrew Jackson well above Nixon, because he was there not quite at the beginning, but at an early moment, at an elemental moment in American life and in American national life. And even if you criticize him for the horrible things that were done to Native Americans and criticize him for being a slave owner, as you certainly can and should, we are forced to acknowledge that he was one of the people who built the very country in which people whose rights he denied were able to claim their freedom later on. It's a really complicated legacy.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep, whose book is called Jacksonland. I'm curious, Steve, how you went about doing your research for this.
Mostly at the Library of Congress, which is here in Washington, D.C. And the researchers are wonderful there. It's just really one of the most wonderful institutions I've been able to deal with in America. And you can go there and order up out-of-print books, or go there and look at a Cherokee newspaper. There was a newspaper called the Cherokee Phoenix. You can look at this newspaper from 1828, and it may be on microfilm, but you may also be holding the actual newspaper. And it's the same with the letters of Andrew Jackson. You can go in there and find them in these thick 1,000-page volumes published by the University of Tennessee. It's an amazing series. But a lot of letters are not in those volumes, or are not in volumes yet. And you end up finding them, some of them in the Library of Congress. And again, on occasion, I was holding an actual 200-year-old or almost 200-year-old letter written by Andrew Jackson in his scrawl, his sometimes angry handwriting, and certainly angry words. And you feel really closely connected to people when you're able to get your hands on the documents like that.
And, you know, I was asking you earlier about what motivated you to take on the task of writing about this very complicated man. But, you know, at the end of the day, with all this work that telling a story like this involves, what made this a passion project for you, Steve?
Democracy, to put it in one word. That's what I cover in my day job. I was bothered by the way that our politics were turning out in recent years. I wanted to understand things better. That drove me back into history. And the more I learned about this story, the more that I began to feel that I was onto something. That this was a story that I sort of knew the surface of, but it was like looking at the surface of the ocean. And I didn't know about all the life that was going on underneath. And I wanted to understand better and better what had happened, why those things had happened, why it was that there were, in effect, two maps of the United States, one that was just states and territories and one that had the Indian nations in some of the very same places, and why it was the government actually recognized those both of those contradictory maps, and why it was that one map was then slowly eliminated. I wanted to understand that story that's at the beginnings of our democracy, because I think that this is a moment in history when we want to come to a new understanding of that. This is a moment in history when the United States is changing demographically. That in some way touches on almost every kind of news story that we do. It certainly affects our politics. A lot of people are anticipating that change. A lot of people are anxious about that change. And we all face a question about how different kinds of people from different parts of the globe, or whose ancestors are from different parts of the globe, will come together and respect everybody's rights while also managing to remain one unified nation. That's the question we face now, and it's the question they faced differently then. And really, thinking about history for me is an opportunity to reconsider the present.
In the end, how do you assess the legacy of Andrew Jackson?
Wow. He made a lot of the country, that the rest of us have inherited. You can't take that away from him. But you do have to force him forever, or his image forever, to confront the awful things that were done in the name of the United States. This is a guy who believed in the security of the United States, but also believed in exploiting real estate. And he figured out his ideas of national security in a way that would perfectly match his real estate interests. This is a guy who could be fair-minded to people, except when his financial interest was involved. And that's something for all of us to think about. I'm sure that that's true of all of us, to a greater or lesser extent, but I think all of us would like to be a little bit less like that when we can, and avoid being too much like that when we can.
And as people weigh the good and bad parts of Andrew Jackson, the bad in many ways, looking back, seems to be overtaking the good, and we have some people today who are advocating for Jackson to be removed from the $20 bill. Should he be?
Well, I wrote a thing in the New York Times a few weeks ago in which I suggested that he should share the $20 bill with John Ross, the Cherokee chief who battled him for more than 20 years. Because then we're not saying Jackson was this great spotless hero, because I don't think we'll find any perfect and spotless heroes in any of history. What we'll say instead then is here were these two imperfect men who battled it out in the democratic system, and it's a great and important democratic story about the creation of the United States. And I'd like to do that with other bills as well, pair up other figures in history who are connected in some way, who together tell a story, so that it's not about the great man theory of history, as they say, but it's actually about the democratic process and how it works and how it sometimes fails.
Steve Inskeep is host of NPR's Morning Edition, heard weekdays on 90.5 WESA. He joined us to discuss his book, Jacksonland. Steve Inskeep, thanks so much.
Oh, glad to do it, and please say hello to all the friends of my colleague David Green there in Pittsburgh.
Will do. Thank you, Steve. More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Experts say that as Mario Lemieux and Ron Burkle explore their options, the Penguins are not being sold to leave, but sold to stay. Our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak, has the latest on the potential sale of the Penguins, the potential for them, for the ownership to change hands, either in part or as a whole, and how the team's circumstances are vastly different from the last time a formal ownership exchange was made. Bob Dvorak joining us by phone. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Paul. How's it going?
It's going well. I, like many Pittsburgh Penguins fans, are a little bit concerned about the news we're hearing that, and it's not official that they are being sold, but it certainly sounds like there is an attempt to, or at least an exploration on the part of the Lemieux-Burkle ownership to see what kind of interested investors there may be out there. Explain what's going on here.
They're making an attempt through a banker house, Morgan Stanley, to see what interest there would be in selling their primary interest in the team. It's sort of like cashing out. You buy low, sell high. It's capitalism at its best, right? Mario wanted to get out of ownership earlier. In 2006, he actually did sell the team to Jim Basile of Toronto, the BlackBerry guru, but the sale wouldn't go through because Basile wanted to move the team. That's never going to happen. The Penguins aren't leaving Pittsburgh at all. So you can rest, you can put those concerns to rest. Mario and Ron Burkle would retain at least some ownership in the team, which would be smart since it's going to be a cash cow for years to come.
And certainly we've heard from other sources that, all the indications are that there's no way that the Penguins would leave Pittsburgh, even though that has clearly been a threat in the past. But what assurances are there, Bob, that if they put this team up for sale and they're willing to entertain any and all bidders, how do we know that someone who buys the team, who has the most money, isn't going to be interested, as was the case nearly 10 years ago, in moving the team out of Pittsburgh?
Yeah, two main things are at work there, Paul. There are stipulations in their lease. It's pretty ironclad. Whoever would buy it and want to move it would have to pay a severe financial penalty to break the lease. And two, who in their right mind would leave a market like Pittsburgh with a rabid fan base, a really good TV ratings, a facility that's been sold out for years, and how would you explain Las Vegas Penguins to anybody?
Well, I mean, haven't they nearly been, what, the Seattle Penguins, the Kansas City Penguins, the Montreal Penguins, or, they were going to move them, I think, up to Canada about 10 years ago, weren't they?
Yeah, the suburban Toronto Penguins, yes. But circumstances certainly have changed because the last time there was any attempt to really sell the team or talk about selling the team was before they had the arena. Now that the arena's in place, that doesn't raise nearly any alarms as it did back then. And one of the things you also look at is just long-term viability as far as, you know, it's been 50 years since for them to grow a fan base, and this fan base is pretty much is set. Generations of people have called themselves Penguins fans.
And the Penguins right now, currently, as you mentioned, they have great attendance, and they have a sellout streak. I'm trying to remember how far back it goes, but it's been years.
It's a couple of, it does go back a couple of years, and it's in the hundreds. I don't expect that to end anytime soon, because there was a pretty substantial waiting list for people just getting in line to buy tickets.
We're talking with Bob Dvorak, our sports guy, who is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus, about the potential sale of the Penguins and the chances that they would leave town, which sound like they are not very good at all, which is a good thing for the city, because certainly...
I was going to say, people will say, well, Mario's just cashing in. They built him an arena with public money, and now he's going to... double or triple or quadruple his investment. But, you know, at the time, the Penguins were available for pennies on the dollar. Anybody could have bought that team and be in a position to cash out too. So, you know, there's always going to be some kind of squawking if there's a public arena involved. But I don't think most Pittsburghers would begrudge him the chance to leave, majority ownership and go back to his private life.
And certainly Mario, his reputation in this city is absolutely golden. And, you know, part of it is that he was a great player, and he led the team to its first Stanley Cup championships, and then became a Stanley Cup champion again as an owner. But isn't he generally perceived as the guy who saved the team for Pittsburgh, that if it were not for Mario Lemieux, that the Penguins would not be here?
Yeah, absolutely. He saved him more than once. He saved him as a player. He saved him when he bailed him out of bankruptcy. And he saved him when the arena issue was still unresolved. So you say, what else does a guy need to do? And there aren't very many families like the Rooneys who stay in something forever and just hand it down from generation to generation.
And as far as the building of the arena, if you can kind of give us sort of an overview of how that all came about, because it came on the heels or in the wake of stadiums being built for the Pirates and for the Steelers. And the Penguins were playing in one of the oldest buildings in the National Hockey League, the old Civic Arena or Igloo. And so Mario looks at this and says, you know, the only way for this franchise to be financially viable is to get a new arena built. And it ends up being done so with public funds. How did that happen?
Well, the Penguins got left out of the ballpark and the stadium and the convention center push at the turn of the century because basically their ownership at the time said we didn't need one. That turned out to be short-sighted thinking. And when the Penguins went back to the city and said, hey, if we don't get a new arena, we're not going to survive, then it was much more difficult to do it by itself. You know, there's always a pushback against public funding for these teams. And the deal was put together with then-Governor Ed Rendell to use casino money. Whoever got the casino license for Pittsburgh would have to put up about $8 million a year to pay for the arena costs. And that's how it came to be. And it was, you know, I remember it was, it came down to the wire because there were talks. I remember being in Kansas City when they were looking to lure a franchise and they were looking at the Penguins, and Mario was actually out there, but using it as leverage in his talks with the Pittsburgh people.
One of the reasons that the Penguins is such a valuable franchise is that they have the twin superstars of Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. Lately, we've been hearing rumors that Evgeny Malkin is discontented, and no longer wants to be in Pittsburgh, is interested in being traded. Is there any truth to that? What do we know about that? And if he were to go away, how would that impact the fortunes of the team?
I, I don't know if those rumors are true. I mean, you know, anytime you don't win, you don't have the success in the postseason that you expect. I mean, if you look at the Chicago Blackhawks, you say, oh, that should have been the Penguins should be the Blackhawks, or the Penguins should be the Tampa Bay Lightning, who are young and coming, and they're going to be good for years and years to come. So, you know, anytime you don't have success, those rumors start. Now, I don't know, will Evgeny Malkin's parents be greeted like they were in any other city? I think he's fine here. But the question is, a trade's always a possibility. I mean, Babe Ruth got sold, so anything's possible. Wayne Gretzky got traded. So if it would have to be a deal that would really have to knock the socks off the Penguins to part with those two, though, one of those two. If you remember the Jaromir Jagr trade, he was unhappy and disgruntled here, traded him to Washington, and that didn't work out at all for either side because the Penguins got nothing in return that resembled his worth as a hockey player.
So, meanwhile, the NHL season continues on, or at least the Stanley Cup final is continuing on, and one of your colleagues, Gene Collier, with the Post-Gazette, a popular columnist, wrote an interesting piece about the length of the NHL season, which begins, if you include the exhibition games, it starts in September, and it's longer than the school year. I mean, the school's out, but the NHL's still going. Is the professional hockey season too long? Tonight, by the way, is game 3 between Chicago and Tampa Bay. And it could potentially go on for another week. Is this whole thing just played out over too long a period of time?
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on your taste, I guess. If you think of sports as the opiate of the masses, it's not long enough. I mean, there would people would watch them year-round. I think the big issue with the length of a season is the health of the players. Can they hold up over that amount of time? And if the players thought it was too long and unhealthy for them, they would certainly say so through their players' association. But, when I was coming of age in the 60s, there was concern in the 70s that there would be overexposure of these sports franchises and sports teams if they were on too much. That doesn't happen. I mean, every league has its own separate channel now. They could go on forever. They put them on every night. They don't care.
Bob, we have about a minute or so left. There are a couple of quick things I wanted to hit before we wrapped up. Sports history was made over the weekend. For the first time since 1978, we have a Triple Crown winner in horse racing. American Pharoah got it done at the Belmont Stakes on Saturday. What were your thoughts as you saw that event unfold?
Not since Khufu built the Great Pyramid has a pharaoh created this kind of a stir, I think. the only mystery to me is how does an Egyptian owner misspell pharaoh? That's what I, you know, but it was a great spectacle. I thought it just really gave maybe a shot in the arm to the horse racing industry because people tuned in to see this thing and to see this horse run. And I'll always remember Secretariat and the record-setting pace, but to do what he did is really remarkable. To win those three races over a period of 5 weeks is really the mark of a champion. It doesn't happen often because it's hard to do, and if it happened all the time, it wouldn't be a big deal. So hats off to American Pharoah and Bob Baffert.
And finally, Bob, with about 30 seconds left, the Cleveland Cavaliers have evened their NBA Finals series with Golden State at a game apiece. There's this debate over whether we, being in close proximity to Cleveland, should root for the Cavaliers, especially when Cleveland as a city is such a rival of ours. Is it okay to root for LeBron and the Cavaliers if you're in Pittsburgh?
It doesn't offend me that Cleveland might win a championship for the first time in 51 years. No, not at all. I mean, you know, this basketball series and that issue is so compelling, I actually watched more than 5 minutes of a game the other night.
Yeah, that old saying that if you watch the last 5 minutes, you see it all. Bob Dvorak is sports writer emeritus for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and he's our sports guy. Bob, as always, great thanks to you.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Tomorrow on the program, we take you to museums and expose you to fine arts. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.